Now, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. Well, we're pre-recording this on Wednesday. It is Veterans Day today. And as with every Veterans Day and everything, the respect goes out. I mean, obviously, our program, all of us, have a lot of respect. And you've got all this stuff all over the media and the news with the respect going out to the veterans today. The question is, what does it mean and how does it all come together and what good does it do? I mean, all of us have had this thing lately where everybody comes up and thanks you for your service. I had it at Walmart a little while ago and they handed me a cookie, but they have no idea what all this is. So we're going to continue our conversation that we had. Ray and I are going to talk about the meaning of war, what it is, what happened to us, where we're going. And let's get back into some more of the tactics stuff. I mean, last week we had to get the stuff done on the medical. That was really important because participating in the medical treatment things to get all of the biological markers is essential for medical care. Ray, how are you today?
I'm good, Doug. Just wonderful to be with you. Hope you're doing well.
Well, thank you very much. I kind of like a bad day. I did Joyce Riley's program on the Power Hour this morning. Chris Thomas joined us, Chris and Kathy Thomas. Chris was one of my DU-friendly fire casualties during Desert Storm that's never got proper care. And it just brought everything back home again. Yeah. And I did try what you said, by the way.
Oh, good. I hope you did.
Yeah, I went and got an inhaler. I'm not sure how much good it did because it just left to hear Chris's story and you go back to the archives for the Power Hour with Joyce Riley. And again, people are not aware, Joyce Riley was a U.S. Air Force captain, medevac nurse, flying Nightingales on 141. So she knows where she's at and what she's talking about with the military. It's not like all of us involved trying to get the information out. We're not involved. We were deeply involved all the way across.
Right.
That really bothered me because Chris was a casualty of friendly fire.
Right.
I mean, an Abrams tank shot three rounds, 120-millimeter DU at him. And he's got shrapnel in his body. He's got all the physiological effects from it. And you've got every time I come around and any time it hits Memorial Day or Veterans Day, I got to ask the question, why?
Right.
I mean, what was this about and why? I mean, you and I were both young puppies when we went to Vietnam.
Right.
A long time ago.
My granddaughter asked me whether the Civil War I fought in, so that gives you an idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's a whole other perspective. I mean, we were, you know, maybe all 18, 17, 18, 19, 20 years old at that time.
Yeah.
And we've lived a full life since then. But what did it mean? I mean, you were a Marine. You went in Vietnam. You saw the worst of the worst. Your unit was wiped out. I mean, literally wiped out on the ridge. And then we keep going to all the wars, and we keep seeing the casualties mounting. And then we keep seeing the inadequate medical care that's still happening for Vietnam vets with Agent Orange horribly. I mean, it's a day in and day out where I don't find out that happening too. And then we got all the casualties from everything from Vietnam forward, Desert Storm, incredible casualties from Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom. And there's only a true handful of casualties that are what we call wounded in action during an engagement with the enemy.
Right.
I mean, your unit got wiped out, but, you know, so many others, the majority of the casualties from Vietnam weren't at the fact that they got bullets or bombs, the fact that they were exposed to depleted uranium, or not depleted uranium, they were exposed to Agent Orange and all of these other endemic diseases, weren't they?
It was. We've lost so many. And the point of it, Doug, is that they suffer throughout the time, emotionally, physically, every other way, spiritually, any other way. Some of it seems to be there is no justification for some of it, and I think that's part of the mental problem or the mental emotional problem that we deal with sometimes, because there is, you know, how do you justify certain things? And you talk about friendly fire. I mean, it's bad enough being wounded, but when it comes from your own friendly fire, that takes away a little bit I think it adds to the burden that you have to live with the rest of your life. It was really unnecessary.
Friendly fire was absolutely rampant during Vietnam. There's no doubt about it.
Right.
And then the other part we had over there, and everybody heard it, they had fragging also.
Sure.
And, I mean, fragging, I know for people in a new generation don't understand it. I mean, for whatever reason, our own soldiers got pissed off at their own leaders and either wounded them or killed them, didn't they?
No, and people, in my book, The Never Ending War, when the first unit, the reunit I did go to, I went to the rear area first, and then after 2 days of being given gear and stuff, we went out to the bush. But during that first 2 days, the first night, I think it was, or second night I was in Vietnam, they would tell us, you know, if we had our incoming or like rockets or mortars, it would, you know, you hear explosion, you jump in this trench with your helmet, flak jacket, weapon, things like that. It sounded really exciting. But during the night, I heard two explosions, boom, boom, and everybody was hollering, incoming. So everybody jumps in the ditches. And after a few minutes, they said, all clear. So we got out. It was like, wow, this is really exciting. But then come to find out what it was, somebody was disgruntled about a sandbagging detail or something, and they had fragged a one of the gunnery sergeants or first sergeant, somebody, who was in charge of that detail. And when the guy walked into his tent, two grenades came in behind him. Now, I'm going to tell you what that did to me, Doug. That made me question the brotherhood of thinking, I don't know who I'm with here. And everybody is armed, and everybody is deadly, and, you're hoping everybody's going to have an enemy that you're going to be looking for the enemy, but sometimes the enemy is among you and you don't know who it is.
I mean, that whole concept is frightening. I mean, we absolutely, and I mean, it's famous in Vietnam, Khe Sanh, B-52s dropped the bombs on our own troops, and that happened more than once, and, you know, definitely dropped a lot of bombs on the enemy, and we had to do that. That was given part of the war.
Yeah.
But then we keep going through all this stuff, and as we got to more involvement over the years in the Middle East and total involved in Central America and the Caribbean, and then we kept our involvement in Korea, and Korea has never ended. I mean, all it is an armistice there right now, and they're still trading shots back and forth across the line of demarcation.
DMZ, really.
Pardon?
I guess it's the DMZ is what they call it.
Yeah.
So they still are.
So every Veterans Day I come up on what the reason is. I mean, in our local newspaper, the News Gazette, again today, one of the local car dealers took out an entire ad, an entire page in the newspaper. You know, and that's not cheap.
Right, right.
By any stretch of the imagination. And what it was, again, you know, it's that crazy poem, you know, and this really bothers me, you know, and it's attributed to a Marine guy, and it's always been a soldier, you know, not the reporter that gave freedom of the press and all freedom of speech and everything else.
Right, right.
And that's so far from reality that it scares me, and I understand where it came from and the purpose of it is. We have to find the individual soldier or the warrior or the family member have to find some justification for their loved one's sacrifice.
Yeah.
Or the individual has to find some justification for their individual sacrifice.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm a proponent of a good defense is a good offense. And I believe a strong military is good for the nation as a world peace and everything else. Most countries do have a strong defense. Even if they don't have a good economy, they do have a good defense. But they don't run all over the world, spread themselves thin, get in two or three wars at a time, sending their young men and women into battle for somebody they don't know, and for whatever reason they only follow orders. And so if we could choose our battles a little bit better, we might end up with a more focused military. And I think we've just played it out so much that, you know, I don't know why I went to Vietnam. I did because I wanted to be part of it. I wanted to be part of my military. I wanted to be a Marine. I wanted to do this and that and the other. But people say, why'd you go? Well, I was told to go. And that's where they were. Everybody was going. And, you know, if it had been Korea, it had been another place. If it had been, you know, wherever it was, that's where I was willing to go. We have veterans that are from Somalia, from you know, just all over Indonesia, everywhere. Everybody's been somewhere if you talk to some of these veterans. And you have to ask a question. Why in the world do we have to be the police for the entire world? Why don't we just take care of us for a while? Get us healed up, and maybe we'd even be more powerful.
I mean,
if we were changing the world for better, it'd be good. But I don't think we are.
We're talking more involvement in, you know, in Southeast Asia. We're talking about sending the Navy into the South China Sea.
Right.
You know, trying to stake out our territory, even though it's not our territory and we have no business there.
Yeah.
I get frightened because then, like today with Chris Thomas, explaining what's happened to him and the abandonment that he had, the fact that it was all friendly fire.
Yeah.
And I think that hit me the hardest, as we talked about, and as you know, and everything. I'm the guy that was ordered to clean it up, and I directed the medical care.
Yeah.
That they, to this day, are still ignoring.
Well,
and you come back and you ask the question, why?
Yeah.
And then we've got all the incredible casualties from Operation Iraqi Freedom, Enduring Freedom, over 1.5 million.
Right.
And only less than maybe 50,000 of those, 40, 30,000, something like that, were actually wounded in action.
Yeah.
But incredible casualties, and you got to ask the question, why?
Well, when you send somebody to war, usually there are no real non-casualties. Everybody is affected in some way, emotional or physical or mental or moral, and they come back wounded in some sort, some way. Usually people are just not the same. Now, when you're sending them over there 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times, you're compounding the injury. And there's going to be some injuries in 8 tours of duty when you're going to do like that. The reason is they don't have the manpower to do what they want to do, so you have to replicate everything. And what you're doing is you're wearing people out. How can you expect a guy to be a normal human being that's been to a third world country and in a war zone 8 different times? I don't know how you do it, Doug. And it's almost like it's not even a collateral damage, really. It's more of a just a death sentence, in a sense, because they will never be a non-casualty. They have been brutalized and demoralized in every way you could imagine, and it will have a cost to it.
I think that, I mean, you're bringing up a concept here that everybody's a casualty. And I'm not sure that's looked at it, because when you talk about casualties in the general public, the only ones that they recognize are the ones that were wounded in action in direct engagement with the enemy.
Right.
I mean, the VA and the military and the civilians don't look at everybody else as a casualty. And yet,
right,
in most cases, as we all know, those casualties that were developed from friendly fire or from the complex toxic exposures, they're in worse condition by far than the individual who was wounded in action.
Right.
Because with the advances in medicine and everything, those that are wounded in action, hey, they can get healed.
Well, combat has a lot of heavy emotional stuff to it. Audie Murphy was one of my heroes. And Audie Murphy was in a lot of combat. He won more medals in World War II than any other soldier in any army. But he came back, and he continued to move on. He went into movies. He did different things. And people were treating him really great. But he also drank a lot. He self-medicated himself. And he never got out of the emotional battles. He couldn't sleep at night. He had a strong post-traumatic stress, severe post-traumatic stress. And it was going to shorten his life one way or the other. And that was a war that was, you know, the Great War, World War II. There was a lot of reasons to go over and do those things. But when you lack those purposes and reasons and justifications, it takes a little bit out of that, because the war is the same. I don't care what war you've been in. War is war. People are dying. People are being hurt. There are a lot of casualties, whether civilians and the enemy. But when you come back, there's always that question in your mind, why did they sacrifice you to do something for some purpose that they couldn't? They might have figured it out another way. Who invited us to go? Who wanted help? And sometimes we got it, and sometimes we didn't. But I know where I've been in countries, Doug, they didn't act like they liked us too much. And the civilians didn't like us too much because they thought we were stirring up everything. And that's kind of the thing. You know, I am 100% for the military. I'm 100% for our country. But I think they ought to choose their battle a little careful, more careful. It's costing lives. It's costing people not only death, but there's costing their lives because we're hamstringing them. The divorce rate with Vietnam veterans is I've read where it's 94%. That's horrendous. Can you imagine lives who have been turmoil and depleted because of things that happened in their life that caused them to go to substance abuse, trying to self-medicate their own selves, and the children who have grown up in that kind of dysfunction? Can you imagine? I know two veterans have been married 9 times, and there's a lot of that. And so we look at the entire picture there, and you're thinking, what could we have done to ward off some of that? And it's really created a lot of problems for a lot of people.
You know, and I don't see the problems ending. I just see it getting worse. I mean, we had the revelation in the brand new Army Times that we've talked about it. And again, what it was, and the Army Times is on the newsstand right now that came out on Monday. Some people got in the mail last Friday or Saturday if you have a regular subscription.
Right.
But the editorial is there confirming that the military deliberately and willfully did not include the information of all the toxic exposures in individual medical records, and they don't even make that accessible. And again, a deliberate disobedience, a deliberate willful act, with the blessing of the leadership in the Pentagon to allow this to happen. And then I see all of the people that are injured and sick and ill, and we've talked about it ad nauseum on this program. I mean, you're addressing it on a regular basis there at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina.
Right.
And it's horrific. Yeah. So whether we look at the contamination there, when we destroyed the infrastructure, I mean, obviously we're releasing inorganic, organic chemical compounds. We're releasing biological materials. We're releasing all of the pesticides, and they're basically, inorganic compound. And then we're releasing all the radiological materials. Then we're shooting the place up with our DU munitions, which, they're absolutely incredibly effective. I mean, I got the firsthand knowledge of that. And yet, you can't clean up the contamination that you do, and then you put it all over creation, these areas that have, and people have to still live there. But now their air, water, soil, food is contaminated. The soldiers are sick and can't get proper care. Nobody talks about the, i.e., I don't know how to define it, collateral damage, and collateral damage is just the non-combatants and the civilians in the area. And then what I've heard over and over again, and this cropped up again here about on Monday, an individual combat medic didn't get deployed to Iraq, but got cross-contaminated when all the stuff came back, and from the immunizations, and they're sick just as if they were deployed.
Well, yeah, it's I read statistics one time about Vietnam. And they were saying they lost 1 million men during the Vietnam War, this is the North, to just malaria. That's hard to believe. But they said they lost more men to malaria than they did in the war itself. But since the war, they've lost a lot more men and a lot more women and a lot more people from the toxins and from the they talk about how high the post-trauma for their people is. So we think of us, but there's a lot more people out there being affected by this stuff. They have to live after it's all over with. They're like you said, their country still has been turned up, plowed up, bombed up, everything in the world, and you know we drop toxins. And I know on the DMZ, that's where I was, and I have stuff on my arms and my forehead and places like that were exposed to Agent Orange, and I remember it falling on us and like raining, and they would say, "Don't look up, don't look up," until you let it wet you down. And we didn't know what they were doing. We thought it was killing mosquitoes and stuff, as far as what we knew. And we were like, yeah, this is good, this is good. But then many times we were drinking water out of bomb craters and ditches and where we could find it. And so you're getting water that you don't even think of it, but it's been infected by Agent Orange. And, you know, and so you never know. You're laying on the ground at night and you're rolling in the stuff. And so, you know, it does have a after effect. And I don't know where it ends, Doug. This is just one place that we're talking about.
I'm sitting here looking at the medical directives. And this is a Department of Veteran Affairs directive to the physicians. Some things you need to know about veterans. A clinician's guide to veteran-specific issue. This is issued by the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs Division 11, which covers Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, you know, this area here and here. And they talk about all of the different problems associated with the events from combat. I mean, for PTSD. Now, right now we're seeing PTSD, and PTSD has been treated or attempted to be treated as a psychological problem by psychologists. And in all the years that I know everybody going to it and working through the stuff and sitting there, it ain't even made any difference on how they on the improvement of the life, really.
Yeah.
I mean, we know the signs and symptoms of PTSD and, you know, again, recurring thoughts and mental images or nightmares. I mean, that's a given, okay?
Right.
I mean, that's just a flat given. It's not going to change. You got all the sleep problems and changes in appetite. Experiencing fear and anxiety when exposed to an event or information, again, the characteristics of a traumatic event. That's what hit me a few hours ago with Chris Thomas. I mean, it all came flying back, and we tried to get him medical care. We ordered his medical care, and they deliberately didn't give it to him. Even after Shinseki personally signed the order and Ron Peake personally signed the order. I mean, these are multiple generals, multiple VA secretaries. Being overly alert, startling very easily, and being on edge much of the time. I mean, today when you're not that in that environment, there's no reason to be there. But as you said, I mean, that adrenaline rush.
Yeah.
When you get back into a situation that reminds you, that adrenaline goes nuts in your body.
Well, it does. And, you know, I talked to you, Doug, about that nasal inhaler that I use all the time. You can buy them at Walmart and places like that. The inhaler
is only for the adrenaline.
There are times that I get depressed. There's times that I get aggravated. There's times when I really get frustrated. The nasal inhaler doesn't help that. It's those times when you feel your heart about to beat out of your chest, and you go into this fight or flight mode. That's what the nasal inhaler really works for. You know, and I know sometimes you can talk to your friend like that, and you get so depressed and you get so aggravated. But when the adrenaline kicks in, you go into a super speed. And so you know, I don't know if the nasal inhaler helped you today, but you might have been on the doorsteps of a panic attack, because it was triggering that. So, you know, I don't know, but I do know it works. I can promise you that. And if somebody is having panic attacks, that is a good way to neutralize that adrenaline.
Yeah, because you're forcing oxygen into the brain.
Yeah,
depression and sadness with low energy level. Okay, we've all experienced that.
Yeah.
Unable to concentrate and focus on work or daily activities. Difficulty making decisions. Feeling irritable, angry, or become easily agitated. Feeling emotionally numb. I think the emotionally numb is, if anything, I mean, you and I have talked about that, having to be numb. I mean, you yourself had to become numb.
Right.
To survive, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. And it carries on, too, because when I came home, I was numb. My emotions had more or less shut down on me. And I know a lot of guys have, you know, a lot of people have dealt with that. You probably have dealt with it, too, where your body will do certain things to help you cope. You can have so much pain that your body will actually shut down. Your brain will shut down. And you can't remember certain things because your brain blocks it out. And so, you know, our brain is trying to protect us. Even with the adrenaline, that's the way that God put in us to protect us and help us through a terrible situation. But when it begins to be reacted in a non-threatening situation through a memory, now it goes into what is considered a panic attack. So it's a whole different ball game. When it first happened, Doug, you needed it, but now you don't need it. And so it's one of those things that happened from war that takes place after the war. Audie Murphy suffered a lot of panic attacks, and he suffered a lot of depression because he lost a lot of friends. But he didn't know exactly how to handle those panic attacks. And so, you know, other than medications, what they try to do it with, but so you turn to alcohol or you turn to other things that will help to neutralize, or it doesn't neutralize it. What it does, it just helps you to cope with it, more or less. You become fixated on other things. The alcohol has a way of kind of smoothing things over a little bit, and that's where people get into substance use and abuse. And it's a struggle. And people, we're living in a world right now, and all through America, that we're seeing things happen around us, and it can really cause some emotional strain on the brain. Really, you can watch news and be up all night long thinking about it if you don't watch yourself. I use a CPAP for sleeping. You know, they told me I had to have it, and I started using it. I didn't like it, but then I worked it where it does work good. But one thing I do when I go to bed is I take a little bit of Vicks Rub, and I just put a little bit on my nostrils. And then that air pushing into that machine makes sure I get some to my brain, and then I'm able to sleep good all night long. And that has helped me tremendously. So, you know, I could recommend that to other people of at least doing something to make sure you're getting oxygen to your brain while you're sleeping, because I have been up many nights all night long, exhausted, but couldn't sleep. One of the things that did cause that, Doug, and I didn't realize it, was pain medications. The VA put me on medications for different things, and they don't tell you not to take it at certain times, and so you have to learn, don't take these things before you go to bed because you will be up all night long. It disrupts your sleep. And you have to be kind of, you have to proactive on what you're doing and realize what you're doing and maybe cut back or not use it at certain times. Because once you've been up all night, your day is wrecked too. It'll cause you problems all throughout the day.
Yeah, I think it's adrenaline rush.
It's a never-ending war that we can't give up on. We have to constantly fight it.
I want to go back to this adrenaline rush stuff. I mean, for you with the adrenaline, the other combat vets directly involved in a firefight, you're in absolute tranquility 1 second, and the next second you're in sheer terror. You know, don't know where it's coming from, what's going to hit next, or what's going to happen, or who your buddy is, or who's next year, or what's going to happen. For myself and our team, we weren't directly in a firefight, but we were responding to either fixing a total nightmare on a B-52 to get that flight and that mission completed to drop the bombs, or Ronald and I and all the rest of us, we were responding to clean up the friendly fire or the chemical and biological stuff. And there's a unique characteristic, and police and firemen have this, emergency responders have this. I mean, guys who are deep into combat, special ops have this. You get that adrenaline rush, adrenaline surge, and your brain functions on such incredible clarity, and it functions on such incredible strength, physical strength, mental strength, that you can accomplish anything. And not everybody has that gift. or can do that. And I think that's where it delineates between the groups and who does what and everything else. Because I think a lot of these people, you know, and they've talked about this, the guys that do the heroic acts and everything, they didn't know what happened. They didn't have it. They didn't plan it. But their body came together perfectly at the right time with all the capabilities to resolve the problem that was facing them.
Right.
And that's what happened to us. And so later on, when all this stuff happening, and you don't have a crisis situation facing you where you have to respond to everything, life or death hangs in the balance.
Right.
And then if you look up the word
trauma, for instance, it has several definitions of what trauma is. One of them is a life-threatening situation, but other ones are just extremely anxious or something like that. And so, I think the average person probably, they may go through a very traumatic experience once in their life or twice in their life. But when you get into, like, first responders, you get into the military, you get into different things, you're more prone to dangerous situations. You're more prone to big equipment, to weapons of war, from all these things. You know, you're out there and you got a bomb, you're loading bombs on an airplane. I'm sure you have a lot of safety precautions, but you don't want to be dropping a 500-pound bomb and it rolling all over the place. You're doing things that could cause somebody to lose their life, including you. And so when you're around those type of things, you're going to suffer certain traumas, just like firemen, police officers, different people. And so I don't know how you differentiate in, like, one trauma to another trauma. But you can say that any time my adrenaline pumped, when I wasn't wanting it to do it. Now, if you jump off a three-story building onto a little, a little net or something, that's called traumatic too. But you're asking for that one, so I don't know if it works the same way. But when it's thrown in your lap and you have to respond, and your brain produces adrenaline, there is a possibility of something later in life reminding you of that trauma. And that adrenaline begins to pump because your brain thinks it's happening again. And so it could be anything. It could be a sight, a sound, a smell that is reminiscent to the, to the original trauma. And when that happens, your adrenaline begins to pump, and you go into a fight or flight mode. And, that's the way I explained it anyway, Doug.
You know, and then we continue on, obviously, this whole numbness. I mean, you have to become numb to survive. I mean, when we were losing friends, and so distinctive, I mean, May of 1969, Doug and I, Craig and I, got off the B-52, changing track and computer. We're standing on the runway. The aircraft took off, got over Paddy's Point, and promptly blew up. I mean, the only reason we weren't on the aircraft when it was on the aircraft is because we were able to get the tracking computer repaired before the takeoff, or we would have been dead. One of us would have been dead.
Right.
And so you see your friends there, and they're all gone.
Yeah.
I mean, one moment you're talking to them, and the next second there's nothing even there to talk to, or nothing even to find, or even to discuss.
Right. Yeah.
And for you, when you lost your, I mean, how many of you survived the ridge that day?
Well, the original
How many were in your unit, and how many survived?
Well, in the original ambush itself, that particular day, we had 6 bodies laid out in ponchos, and then we had another 36, I think it was, that were bandaged from head to toe. They had head wounds, chest wounds, side wounds. My lieutenant was hit 8 different times that day by shrapnel and bullets. And so you have this whole collage of people. We're throwing them on choppers. Some are having to be carried. Some of them are limping. They're carrying each other. So when they all left, there were 6 of us left out of 42 of us. And
I found out
2 more died later on.
Six out of 42 walk away.
Yeah, there were 6 of us left, yeah. And so, you know, you don't know what's going to happen to the guy you put on there. He had a head wound. I found out through the VA 30 years later, I found out through the VA when I was preparing to kind of get a reunion together. And the reunion consisted of 9 of us that got back together after the ambush. But there were some more that did live. But one of the guys, through I contacted the VA. They were contacting the person I was trying to get it with because he was part of their system. And then they couldn't get him. They would contact me back. They let me know that one of our guys that got shot in the head that day in 1970 died actually in, I think it was 1997. So he lived, you know, 20 years or whatever it was, 20-some years before he died. So he must have been in a state of vegetable, or he must have been paralyzed from, you know, because he was shot in the head. Part of his head was missing. And he survived for a lot of years, but he was probably in a just state of whatever. And they just kept him comfortable until he finally passed away. Now, I mean, you know, you count that and you say, apparently he lost his life that day too.
We have so many today that are so sick and so injured from the toxic exposures.
Yeah.
That they can't survive. I mean, and they're fighting, and this is what Kathy and Chris, I mean, Kathy has to take care of Chris 100%. I mean, here you got an incredible combat troop turned into an RN after the war and then just deteriorated to the point of nothing. And there's no reason for it, because if we had given them the prompt and optimal medical care that I ordered and directed, yeah, that Shinseki then ordered and directed, that General Peak ordered and directed, that the Pentagon ordered and directed, we might have saved his life or improved his life, you know, to the point where they could function and get back going. Because, right, I mean, you have to pick up the pieces and you have to run with it and keep going.
Right.
But this feelings, and this is what happened to Paul Lyons. I mean, we all know it now. He reached the point with hopelessness and complete despair.
Right.
And he committed suicide, and it's had a horrible effect on all of us, because he was a co-host on this program. And his family are just absolutely devastated, as, you know, Tammy came and, you know, talked about it that day with us. The excessive fear for safety of the others and being very protective.
Right.
I mean, that's an ongoing thing. The inability to look about and face aspects of trauma and avoiding activities and places or people that remind of the event.
Right.
These things...
You know, there was a guy named Mick Snyder that was in New York City, and he became really, just really passionate about the homeless people in New York, to the point that he lost everything he had. He gave it all up, and he became a street person. And he was really trying to help the street people to be able to get food and shelter and all these things. And he became so encumbered about it that he eventually committed suicide, because he got so overwhelmed with it. And just like Paul was very passionate about what he did, but he was overcome by it sometimes. And, you know, that's what happens sometimes to us. We come back from situations, and especially if we knew it was wrong, mistakes were made and people suffered from it. And so we're trying to right the wrong. But we have to be careful, because we can get to the point that we can become so depressed and so detached that we began to almost detach our own selves. And so it's always a problem with that. But, you know, we have to remember we have to fight as long as we can. The war hopefully will be won at some point. We may not see it ourselves. But that doesn't negate the fact that we can fight for right and still get some things done along the way.
The thing that's coming about in alcohol and substance abuse, obviously, you know, I'm looking at the medical guidelines, I see that as a major problem, and we've talked about it ad nauseum. I mean, when you don't feel good and you can't live with the memories of everything, you've got to numb yourself down, and the easiest way out is drinking booze, because it puts you into a vegetative state for a few minutes where the brain is totally functioning at another level. And your memories are all gone,
yeah,
and you set it aside, but it's only a temporary thing. And then once the alcohol wears off, all the stuff comes flying back at you with even more vicious consequences, I think.
Yeah, and then you're in a worse state when it does come back, because you're inebriated or something's going on that you've been trying to do, and then when the memories do flash back, you don't know how, you can't fight it like you could. And so it all adds to that. You know, whatever the situation, Doug, it was a watershed moment in our lives. And people do have those life-changing experiences, that will alter the rest of their lives. One thing I tell them in the program that I take to Camp Lejeune and different places is that regardless of your past, whatever it was, it doesn't matter what happened to you. I'm not belittling it or desensitized to it, but whatever happened to you, there has to come a point in life where you won't ever forget it. You won't ever get over it, but you cannot allow it to alter your life. You can't allow your past to determine your future. I think we owed it to our friends who didn't have an opportunity to have a future that we live our future better, that we live our lives better, in their name maybe. But there are so many people in America, not only veterans, but people who have been gone through horrendous things, that it mainly it just shuts down their life. They go into street life. They begin to live on the streets. They begin alcohol, drugs, abuse. And it all happened because something kind of messed their electrical system up inside of them. And they feel like they're no good. They feel like they're less than human. They feel all of these things that are pushing them further and further down. And, you know, when I told in my book that there were certain things that happened in Vietnam that caused guys to really turn their back on society. When they came back, they didn't go home. They went to communes in Washington State, Oregon, Hawaii, different places. And they lived outside of society because they wanted no part of society. They felt like society is what caused their problems. And so they lived and died in that kind of situations. It's too bad that sometimes we allow our past to do so many things. And one thing I have learned, and I tell people all the time, is the only difference between myself and the people that I admire are the choices I make. And you know, we were taught how to fight, Doug. We were taught how to persist in the midst of a lot of decaying situations. If I gave up, I could give my life up. I could be become a victim to it. So I have to fight twice as hard in order to maintain or move forward. You know, that's just what was inbred in us as military people, is that you never give up. You always keep fighting. And we've got some better training than most people have. We've learned those type of things. You know, you don't, just because you have a bad day, you don't let everything slack and take care of itself, because there's people dependent on you. And if you fail, they fail too. And that's what keeps me going, and that's probably what keeps you going too, Doug, is that this is not my own personal vendetta. This is something I do for other people because they haven't heard this sometimes. And, you know, until they hear it, they're not going to be able to move forward either.
And see, that's the thing that it's really horrific, because you see all day, and this is, again, the same thing that happened here. You got on Veterans Day or Memorial Day, especially on Veterans Day, you got all these things out there in the public, thank the vet and do this stuff, but they have no idea what the veteran was involved in.
No.
They want to give them a free meal or, you know, sell a piece of furniture at a cut-rate deal or whatever you're going to get your deal on.
Yeah, right.
But no concept or understanding that the veterans need help, and it's not that the individual themselves has to help us. It's the idea that we have to have a concerted effort behind us to get the people that are responsible within the Department of Veteran Affairs or the Department of Defense to provide the medical care or the support network these individuals in need without any more hesitation, without any more argument. I mean, when I look at all the toxic exposures and all the individuals that affected, and this is what hit me so hard with Chris today, is right. It's unnecessary, because we know what happened and we put out the information and all they had to do was comply.
Right.
But because the leaders want to avoid the responsibility and acknowledging, whoops, I made a mistake, they can't provide the corrective action and move on. And because we want to go in the next battle and kill and destroy, we can't give up weapon systems we have no business using whatsoever.
Right.
There's something really wrong, and I think this is where, I mean, your book and everything points to it, and the conversations we had and what we learned from Paul and ourselves is that PTSD treatment, when you're sitting there talking about it or they're giving you some psychotropic drugs, is not going to solve any of these problems, and that's why it's still ripping the Vietnam vet apart, why Desert Storm vets, and we're seeing the horrific consequences on Operation Iraqi Freedom, Enduring Freedom, and now they want to send the Marine or the Special Operations Team into Syria without justification, without provocation, without any authorization other than it's our decision to go in and do it.
Yeah, yeah.
What's going to happen to these kids?
The justification is if we kill them there, we don't have to kill them over here. Well, there's other ways of thinking about things, too.
They have no capability to attack us or do anything. I mean, see, that's one of the things that bothers me really to the end on Veterans Day and Memorial Day.
Yeah.
We haven't had any enemy whatsoever since the American Revolution in War 1812 that had the capability to suspend our government, suspend our Constitution, or suspend our rights. There hadn't been nobody. Nobody's had that capability or ability to do it. And yet they talk as if all these people could do this stuff. Now, granted, we can have an attack on our soil and it can bomb or blow us apart, but that's not going to do anything to suspend our rights or our freedoms. But yet we're seeing throughout all over across the nation, because of the so-called attacks that we've had, that we're supposed to give up our rights and freedoms for security. I mean, what was it? Ben Franklin said, those that are willing to give up, all these gifts just for temporary security deserve nothing. I mean,
yeah.
I'm not sure if I got the quote right or if that was there.
Right,
just
right.
One of those things that you pick up on.
Right. Well, when you were saying that, Doug, the thought came to me was, I wonder if we had a war where nobody made any money on it, would anybody show up?
Wasn't there a movie, what if you gave a war and nobody came?
Yeah, right. So people do go to war because of economies, because it's good for economies, we talked about this before, and it's like people control, population control, but it does have an effect when you can get rid of 58,000 young men and women who would have had children in the future. That's a little bit of a cutback, so that does help a little bit. But then you stimulate the economy, you create a lot of jobs that wouldn't have been there before. And so countries usually do pretty good if you're not the one being bombed. They're making bombs, they're making bullets, they're making everything in the world. And so countries, it almost looks like sometimes our country has really done rather well on being in war. We are eagles, and, we've done pretty well. Look at America, for instance. It was a warring country. We started a war. That was justifiable. But we've had a lot of wars since then, and you have to wonder why. Why did we do it? Was it for the sake of people? Oh, yeah, we love these people. Yeah, but the average young guy, when they're 18 years old, he could care less. He's just there because he wanted to be part of something bigger than himself. He wanted to get old, look back, say, yeah, I was in the Navy, or I was in the Air Force, and I served my country, and I'm going to a thing tonight. I'm supposed to be doing something for the veterans. It's a church that is having a big dinner for them and all this kind of stuff, and so we're going to set up and do that over there. But it's wonderful for that. But they have no. I talked to a group last night, Doug, and I told them about combat, and I knew I lost them in the middle of it because they could not understand what I was trying to tell them. It was too far, almost like a science fiction movie or something, of what deadly combat is to be in that kind of stuff.
We were playing force on force combat games. I was in the Army National Guard at the time. I was a combat medic.
Right. Right.
And we were going up against blue light, and these, at that time, the Army's elite unit, so, this is all set up. It's a major military operation. We've got basically a brigade against a brigade. This is massive, massive training. And as a combat medic, I was hanging back, and we got a POW. In other words, we're playing the whole POW game and everything. We got blanks, and we got the old laser, weapons where, beep, 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 we'd hit with a laser and all that stuff. And we had individuals we caught behind our lines, and, again, the same thing. And so the one guy's going to take the one guy up, and I got the driver in the Jeep, and he's sitting there. And I said, don't move. Don't move. You can't move. And the guy kept moving. And I said, if you're going to move or try to do something, I'm just going to kill you. That is like, yeah, right, uh-huh, some combat medic going to do this stuff.
Oh.
Well, I took my 45 out of my holster. You know, we got no firing pin in it. We just got the rubber plug on it, okay? Cocked that thing back, and I said, if you move, I'm going to shoot you. And he kept moving, so I put the 45 right up against the side of his head, and I pulled the trigger. I mean, you know, obviously it was safe and everything was going to happen. We were playing a war game, but he promptly crapped all over and peed all over everything because he had no concept and no idea that anybody would do it.
Right.
That's the difference
between
all these wannabes and the stuff that we run into today and the real combat. You reach the point where you have the willingness to do that and you have the capability to do it and you won't hesitate to do it whatsoever.
No, you've crossed over that bridge. I mean, once you've been across that bridge, you know, the people that have never experienced something, they really don't know until they get there. But once you have experienced it, okay, we'll move on to something else now because, you know, that has never left me, Doug, all these years. I'm a Christian now, and I try to be a good Christian and love people. But it has never left my mind as to the abilities and things that you have acquired through life of thinking, if I wasn't a good guy, you would not like me, you know, that kind of deal. Because, you know, Christ did change my life, but I'm telling you, it was some bad boys back then, and we did rowdy things, and we had a license to do it, and you're going to suffer the rest of your life for what you did that you can't reverse it. That's why, you know, we a lot of things in my life that I could not change it for anything. I can't go back and beg pardon. But I did go to God one time, Doug, and I know you've done this too. And you just said, God, if you're real, I need you and help me. And there was a lot of burden lifted off of us. And the reason is because we felt forgiven our past. Now, God didn't say, okay, I want a list of everything you'd ever done. Apparently, he knew it anyway. So I didn't have to give a list. All I had to do was give him a lump. And, you know, and that takes a lot of heat off of me because I do know as bad as it was and as bad as I did, I'm not going to be have that held against me forever. Now, I do have a lot of other problems, but that's not one of them I do still suffer over because I asked forgiveness, and I truly believe I got it, and apparently you did too.
You know, the part part that's horrific here, there is with all the contamination we have all over, whether it be generated in Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Vietnam, the Middle East, or the Far East, Vietnam, wherever we have, or any of the installations here. I mean, we know now that Port Carson, Colorado is horrifically contaminated with DU. We got the old Chanute Air Force Base 3-5 miles from where I'm living right now is contaminated. And yet all these people disregard all this stuff, and the individuals disregard the reality of what has happened until they get sick or they hit the crisis point.
Right.
And then you and I, and you have to do it more with the young kids out there, respond all of a sudden to try, and you got your response team to try and save these guys.
Right, right.
But the question I come in, they bought into the myth and the lies so deep.
Yeah.
That until they hit the crisis point, they can't face it. And once they hit that crisis point and they have to face it, then it all comes apart. And unless you, I think what you said, where you went to God or whatever, you're not going to have the strength to get through that.
No, you've got to have more than what you have. You know, I remember watching a television program one time, Archie Bunker, whatever they called it. One of the guys on the show was a Korean veteran, and the guy had, he became a florist, and he was a big old guy, and Archie was really, you know, saying, you're a florist, you're a, you know, punk, or you're this, or you're that, and he was putting him down, and the guy told him, he said, you know, I was in Korea, and he said, I was in a lot of combat, and he said, I ended up hurting a lot of people, and I killed people, and he said, you know, I came home, and I thought, I'm tired of killing things, I'm just going to start growing things, and he said, I became a florist, and he told Archie, he said, I'm going to come back and tear your head up, what he was talking about, But he was saying, I'm not, you know, I'm a florist, but I'm still a veteran, too. I won't ever change that, but I'm not trying to hurt people no more. I'm trying to help people, and I'm trying to fight this battle a different way now. When I look at these guys' faces, they're 22 years old now, and they've come back from Afghanistan, Iraq, or even the Gulf War veterans, different ones. they're looking at a wall in front of their line, Doug, that says, this is going to haunt you the rest of your life. It's going to alter you. Now, in the military, they'll put you on anti-anxiety pills or antidepressant pills, and it's adding to your problems because now you've got a record, now you've got... And they're looking at possibly being put out of the Marine Corps, the Army, the Air Force, whatever, because they're on medications, and you can't function like you should on those medications. And that they get out, and they don't know what they're going to do. Their lives have been altered. And so what we're trying to get them to do is look at their lives right now and begin to plan for the future. I know it's hard to do, but you're going to have to push yourself, or your future will be here before you know it. And if you're unprepared, it's going to cost you.
That's what we've said over and over again, getting the continuing education, whether you get back in academia or go to a trade school or vocational school.
Right.
You've got to march through and charge it. And then the problem we run into, so many have so many physiological problems today that does inhibit educational capabilities, it does inhibit work function capabilities, that you have to modify whatever you can do. But then the thing that, for me, and this is absolutely a total abandonment, which goes back to the reason of why, don't our leaders just acknowledge and admit what is happening and provide the total prompt and optimal medical care to resolve any problem that the veteran or the veteran's family member has incurred as a result of the service in our nation?
Well, you'd be noted as a whistleblower, and that would have been bad for you because now it's a whole generation of people who did bad things and thought they'd never have to answer for it, or they just threw it under the rug or kicked the can. And now you're saying, so you want me to admit that I'm wrong? Are you realizing what would happen if I did that? And so they, because they cower down and whatever, they're not gonna say that, Doug.
Well, we're out of time again, Ray. Thank you very much. I mean, I wanted to talk about the meaning of war and what was happening today, and this is Veterans Day today, and this will be on Sunday night. So everybody think about this and realize the future is there, but how we got to take care of the past and take care of the veterans. Thank you, Ray, and God bless you, Ray.
Thank you, Doug.